Powered by volunteer community involvement, this is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.
And you're listening to Bikini Drive-In on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. Bikini Drive-In's mission is to analyze horror and science fiction films through an intersectional feminist lens while combining elements of screen and media studies, arts criticism, and gender studies. Since we'll be discussing portrayals of horror and violence, content warning and listener discretion is advised. Also, spoilers ahead. Today I'm joined again by Talia Steele. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Talia Steele is a graphic designer and illustrator based in Winnipeg. She specializes in visual identity, brand development, and creative direction. Her personal work consists of experimenting with color, textures, and commonplace objects to create a whimsical world to find comfort in. You can see more of her work at taliasteele.com or via Instagram at saint_Talica. This week, we're discussing David Robert Mitchell's 2014 film, It Follows.
I used to daydream about being old enough to go on dates. I had this image of myself holding hands with a really cute guy, driving along some pretty road. It was never about going anywhere, really. It's having some sort of freedom, I guess.
Jay, you awake?
What are you doing?
You're not gonna believe me, and I need you to remember what I'm saying.
This thing, it's gonna follow you. Somebody gave it to me, and I passed it to you.
Wherever you are, it's somewhere walking straight for you. All you can do is pass it along to someone else.
I'm scared. I need to find him.
What did he really do to you?
Apparently, he used a fake name to rent a house in the city.
This isn't real, I swear to you. This is just some game. If it kills her, it gets me. And goes straight down the line to whoever started it.
What exactly is supposed to be following you?
I don't know.
Something happened. It's not what she thinks, okay?
You don't believe me. Mom?
No, it's me.
Everything's okay.
It could look like someone you know, or it could be a stranger in a crowd. Whatever helps it get close to you.
After carefree teenager Jay has sex with her new boyfriend Hugh for the first time, she learns that she is the latest recipient of a fatal curse that is passed from victim to victim via sexual intercourse. It, Jay learns, will creep towards her as either a friend or a stranger. Jay's friends don't believe her seemingly paranoid ravings until they too begin to see the phantom assassins and band together to help her. Talia, what is your history with It Follows?
So I saw It Follows in theaters, actually. I was going to the movies to see another movie. I don't really remember what the movie was that I was going to go see, but that movie was sold out. So I just kind of picked It Follows randomly and immediately was blown away by it. The soundtrack, so fun. I find it to be a really nice homage to like 70s, 80s slasher movies, which is really cool. And it just creeped me the hell out the whole time. I also really love how you can't tell what year it is, and I think that gives it a really eerie vibe. It almost like reminds me of The Ring, which like also has like a thing that follows you, which I really love The Ring. So anyways, it's definitely an instant classic for me. What about you?
I first saw it a few years ago after renting it from Movie Village. I really enjoyed it, but hadn't rewatched it until recently for the show. And this time, I think maybe because I just finished reading The Ruins, which is kind of about this relentless sentient vine that kills and eats tourists. But I found It Follows to be much more unnerving this time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think it's just like the feeling of being watched and the inevitability of this force that kind of permeates throughout the film that really like spooked me. I also just started projecting at Cinematheque. So I'm just like alone in a dark theater at night a few times a week. And so I'm like already like on edge.
Oh my God. No kidding. It's like dark and like there's like a light that like ominous, like red light. And
yes.
Who could be behind you? Who knows?
I was some tall, spooky man with no eyes coming from a hallway. Oh, horrifying.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
So scary.
Yeah. I have a quote here from an essay from The Final Girls by Isaura Barbé Brown. It's titled Bloody Perfect, I Think We're Alone Now. And they write, director David Robert Mitchell has said that the idea for the film came from a reoccurring nightmare that something was slowly, relentlessly coming for him. He wanted to make something that was impossible to escape, so passing it on isn't enough. You need to pass it on to someone who will try and survive. If they get got, it's time, it comes right back to you. Thus, the supernatural STD was born, and who better to be passing it around than bored, horny teens?
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
That's so funny because I feel like it totally has dream vibes. Like, I've been having really weird dreams lately, and I'm like, this is totally like something out of a nightmare.
Yeah.
Which is great.
Yeah. It has like very like nightmarish imagery. And it also just has like a very sleepy feel to it, whether it kind of has this like hazy look whenever they're indoors. I just assume it's because like everyone parents smoke in the house.
Yeah.
So everything looks kind of smoky and hazy and sleepy, and even like to the dialogue, everything kind of has this like sleepiness
slow.
To it.
Yeah,
and kind of gray and slow.
Super interesting.
Yeah,
I like that.
Sure. Do you consider It Follows a slasher film?
In a way I do. Yeah. Like, it has the creature, I guess in this case, it's an entity of some sort, that stalks you and kills you. And the teens, you know, all slashers have teens in them. And then I just feel like that in itself is like a loose, formula for a slasher movie. So maybe it's like a slasher 2.0 or something like that.
Like a post slasher.
Yeah, like post-punk, but like post-slasher, it definitely stands apart from a lot of like the new horror movies that are being pumped out today. It takes like all the themes that we love like from traditional horror movies and makes it quite the hit for horror genres. As we know, horror doesn't always get like the best reviews in general, but you know, similar to Get Out and Hereditary, like those movies did really well and had like all those same kind of like the formula of like the horror that we enjoy. And I feel like it definitely gives hope to the fact that there can still be new classics today, which is very nice. And I recently just saw a clip from Scream, the original Scream, that made me think of this movie, and it was Randy talking to the people at the house party as they're watching a horror movie in the living room, and he says, there are certain rules you must abide in order to successfully survive a horror movie. Number one, you can never have sex. So It Follows, well, as teens having sex and getting pushed into having sex, or punished for having sex rather, but you know, it's almost like they play off that trope and thought, what if we had a horror movie where you not only get punished for having sex, but you have to have sex to survive? So I think that's kind of an interesting take on that like weird trope that is in every slasher.
yeah, totally. Yeah, it's hard to say like what the filmmaker's intention was. Like, is it supposed, like, are we supposed to see the teens as being kind of like punished for having sex? Because I do find it's kind of like a non-judgmental about it, which is like very like nice and refreshing. And all the sex in the film is consensual, which I think is like very great. And I don't really see like the characters being like villainized for it. It's just something that happens. Like, it's I don't know where I'm going with this thought. But Yeah, it does like play with that trope of like these sexualized kind of like disposable teens. Sorry for quoting Marilyn Manson, but
that shall not be named.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely borrows like certain trappings from slashers. So like you mentioned, so like a group of teens being hunted and it's set in suburbia. But it also has its own set of rules separate from the genre. So there is like a supernatural element of it or the entity, which is just like this evil force. It also has some sort of like body horror elements as it or the infection is passed through the body, similar to like an STI or anything like that.
And yeah.
I thought that was like such a interesting way to go about it.
Oh yeah, for sure. Like even the first scene of the movie where like you can just see like what happens to you when like when her leg is like broken in half like the other way on the beach, like that, it's like, well, what does it do? Like it kind of makes you question that.
It's doing a lot of like, it's kind of talking about sex in lots of different ways, I think, especially when it is situated in sort of like a teen film and like surrounding teens and kind of like whatever like sort of relationship issues or awkwardness or like being pressured to have sex or like what sex is for and all that stuff. I think it's like, I don't know, it's doing a lot and I find it very, very interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. It also manages to be an original story in the style of slashers from the 70s and 80s without constantly referencing these films. And while there are like a few shots, like for example, there's one of Jay who's played by Maika Monroe. She's sitting in the back of her, what I'm assuming, like a college class. And while the teacher's reading, she's kind of looking out the window and sees the older woman kind of like in a hospital gown walking very slowly towards her. And that's very like a reference to Halloween, but I don't feel like it's like beating over the audience over the head with it.
Yeah, definitely. That is a very terrifying scene.
Yeah, it's so scary.
Yeah.
And I just feel like a lot of new films or even remakes and sequels are constantly like calling on these old films and like heavily rely on references without actually having like original idea. And maybe It Follows kind of started that trend.
Yeah, I can definitely see that for sure.
Yeah, especially if you consider like the new Halloween films, which I haven't seen the latest, like Halloween Kills, but the one from a couple years ago, I just felt it was so much like, hey, remember this? And then like the same kind of like music spikes or whatever, right?
It gets kind of old after a while. Like I saw that they're redoing the Chucky like franchise, like they're doing another like Chucky movie. And it's like, I mean, maybe like, I don't know who like appreciates that a lot. I just enjoy like the original, more original ideas, like something like It Follows or even Hereditary. But I feel like there's a lot of like redoing and like remakes and stuff, which like can be good. Like I really liked the Suspiria remake. Like I actually liked it a lot more than the original.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. Like it just depends how they do it or how they can change the story like in their own way.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Suspiria is such a great example of like how to do a remake while also expanding on the original mythology and sort of like reformatting the original film completely.
Yeah, I love that movie. Like a whole different, I know, it's so good. It's like a whole different movie than the original. Like same idea, but like you know, that director's like own interpretation of like the story, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely. Versus like Halloween, and even like I watched the latest Scream trailer and it just looks like very
the same formula. And it like, I don't want to say it like cheapens like the original, like it just kind of makes it like you have to like separate them, because sometimes it's like I don't want to like associate that with like all the extra remakes that they've made, because it's kind of disappointing. But
I
digress.
yeah exactly. Now we're just like on a tirade. It Follows is part of the mumblegore subgenre. So I have a quote here.
I've never heard of that before.
Have you heard of mumblecore?
I have never heard of mumblegore before, and I like the I mean like yeah I read a little bit about it, but Tell me more.
Let me tell you all about it.
Yeah.
So, a byproduct of the mumblecore movement, a special genre of independent film, basically any movie that Greta Gerwig starred and directed. Mumblegore is a millennial era brand of horror that relies on dialogue, low budget aesthetics, and interpersonal relationships to develop scary stories. The actions and speech in these films often feel improvised, and directors like to employ B-movie minimalism that maximizes the limits of a small budget. So for example, we have House of the Devil, The Innkeepers, VHS, The Invitation, and You're Next. And I would say It Follows kind of falls under that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Oh, that's so interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Mumblegore.
And I feel like this is especially true kind of in the casting and the acting choices. I really love the cast. They feel like actual teens.
Mm-hmm. Yep. They definitely do.
Yeah. And even if their dialogue is kind of like minimal or awkward or whatever, that feels like authentic or whatever, if that makes sense. But yeah, it's not like a quippy style. It feels more, more natural.
Yeah. Not like as rehearsed, but just like natural. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to talk about was the kind of the gaze and the voyeurism and the point of views that we see in this film. So It Follows just like does such a great job of playing with gaze, both the viewers and the characters, as well as the entities. So in some scenes, it feels like the audience is implicated in its gaze and in the voyeuristic shots of Jay's body. I have a quote here from Ms. Magazine, an essay titled It Follows, a horror film that doesn't blame the victim for having sex, by Natalie Wilson. They write, the camera work is true to the It Follows title, deliberately moving from the view of those being followed or watched and those doing the following or watching. Utilizing a heightened male gaze style for much of the film, It Follows comments intriguingly on the pervasiveness of this gaze, pointing the finger at audience members by sometimes aligning our vision with the film's creepy stalkers, lecherous adults, and questionable parents. The intentional gazy feel of the camera, where some scenes verge on slow motion while others capture the effect of looking at the screen from the pair of eyes, results in an immersive, uncomfortable experience, which prompts us to see ourselves as both victim and victimizer. Mm-hmm. And this is especially true when we first meet Jay. I believe it's like from a kind of a shot far away that slowly gets closer to her as she's like getting ready to go swimming in her pool.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like we're seeing it from a viewer, but then also later on, you notice that like her neighbors are spying on her at the same time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's that in itself is like, gives it a very eerie vibe, even though like it seems like just a normal day, like in her life, but you kind of see it in that way. It kind of gives it a new meaning. And yeah, like I feel like there's a lot of themes in this movie, and maybe if not the main theme of the film being the public consumption of female bodies. Mm-hmm. I saw a quote on Horror Homeroom, which is titled, What's the Real Horror? And It Follows. And it says, the ball thrown in the bathroom scene of It Follows serves as a reminder that even though adults can usually choose what they do with their bodies, they cannot always choose what is done to their bodies. So Jay examines her own body, but she is not the only one who's doing so. The neighbor boys follow her around, trying to see her in bathing suits or her underwear. When she first notices them, she merrily laughs and tells them, I see you, clearly unshaken by their presence. However, this lighthearted interaction occurs before she is sexually violated and stalked. When the ball hits the window, the viewer must first suspect it was thrown by it before discovering that it was the neighbor. This draws a direct comparison between the sexual stalker and the seemingly harmless boys who are performing the same basic function. Like it, their pursuit is sexually motivated. Unlike it, they are not drawn to Jay by any of her actions, but rather the inescapable fact that she has a mature female body. The boys are fully disconnected from the supernatural element of the film's horror. They begin chasing Jay before it did, and will likely continue to chase her long after it is passed on. Their existence is thus arguably more disturbing than its, because they manifest the sexual pursuit that occurs in reality. The monster can be left on screen, but these seemingly harmless voyeurs are the predators who may be found in the real world of the viewer. So it is interesting that the boys peeping on Jay in the bathroom and like around her home are kind of disconnected from this whole like STI stalker, if mm-hmm. That's what you want to call it. But at the same time, it's still really unsettling and sinister in a similar way because mm-hmm. The article says it's like a glimpse as to what these boys could turn into from this act, and be possibly more harmful. And Jay's friend Paul has this like fascination and infatuation with her. Like, it's not like as creepy as like this whole SDI stalker thing. But there were definitely a few moments that made me cringe. But there are just something like, there's just something about the clearly like friend zone boy with this like passive aggressiveness that creeps me out. And it's just very uncomfortable and unsettling. And these boys in these situations are not the entity, but like real people that can be just as frightening. So all this to say that it reinforces one of the main themes of the film, being that women's bodies are constantly being viewed under a microscope.
Mm-hmm. There's also that sense, especially with the neighbors, that it's kind of like a boys will be boys thing.
Yes.
That it's seen as like harmless. It's like, oh, they're just little kids, but it's like, there's still like a boundary that's
not and they're being still respected. Like, and you learn so much when you're young. So like, if nobody is telling you like, hey, you're not supposed to be doing this, like this is inappropriate and like bad, they're just going to keep doing it. And like, who's reinforcing that? Also, there's just like such a lack of like parents in the movie, which is interesting. So like, you know, you see like maybe a glimpse of her mom, like the mom's talked about, the dad, like, we know he's passed away. So, you know, not a lot of parents in this, in this world.
Yeah. And well, we can talk, we'll talk about it a little bit when we kind of talk about class, but I think it is interesting that it is like Jay's mom. It's like a single mom. And I just kind of assumed that she was like working quite a bit, or they didn't want, they didn't really want to like burden her with their problems, but definitely not lack of parents is an interesting sort of part of this film.
Yeah, it is very interesting. And something else that I noticed, like, is somewhat related to this, that I think is really cool, is like the use of water in the film and like what it symbolizes. And so like Jay and her friends are constantly around areas with bodies of water. The first scene, it starts with the beach, and then one of the last scenes, it ends with a pool. And water, I feel like, often symbolizes tranquility and calm. And in the case of It Follows, water is where a lot of them are seeking refuge. So the girl in the beginning goes to the beach. Jay hangs out in her pool multiple times. The friend group goes to the lake near the water. And then they finally go to an indoor pool to lure and trap the demon. And it's kind of funny that water can be like this very open and vulnerable area, but although you're able to see all around you, but nothing can really sneak up on you. So it's possible that water symbolizes childhood, especially in Jay, where we believe is safe and reliable. And Jay reminisces a few times about how she would fantasize being an adult as a child. And now that she's grown up, it's not all that it's cracked up to be. And by the end of the movie, even though she's still alive and has possibly killed the demon by luring it into the water, which I mean, I guess is only safe for humans in this scenario. But she constantly has to still watch her back. Like the end scene of the movie, like she's holding hands with Paul, I think his name is. There's like someone in the background, like walking still. So it's still like, did they kill it? All of this to say, like, is it a metaphor for like the death or the loss of your childhood, or circling back a metaphor for women being followed and gazed at by men all the time? I feel like it's definitely up for interpretation, but it feels like both.
Yeah, definitely. Especially because, in the pool scene, when the figure, the entity or the demon or whatever appears, it is in the form of her father. I think that it's intentionally being kind of cruel, but then it is connected to her sort of like talking about her childhood, and kind of like, this circling back. Yeah, that's really interesting. And like, swimming is also like, or being in water is also just like very playful and like brings you back to being a child.
Exactly. Like going to the beach, like, you know, playing in the water, like sandcastles, like, you know, playing in your backyard, like if you have a pool, then like playing in your pool, and very, very playful and childlike for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Also, I want to bring up how interesting the soundtrack is to this whole movie. The soundtrack to this movie is done by Disaster Piece, which is by a man named Rich Vreeland. Definitely like John Carpenter's work in Halloween. But oddly enough, I read an article researching about this movie, and Rich Vreeland claims he isn't even familiar with John Carpenter's soundtracks, which I find so
Okay,
surprising.
that's a lie. Like,
I'm like, I don't believe you.
yeah, okay, liar.
I know. So I'm like, yeah, you like it's just so obvious to me. I've read like actually a few articles that said that like John Carpenter's Halloween or like even John Carpenter's like soundtracks in general, like it's just so obvious to me. In the article he says, I think because synths can create sounds that are not always analogous, analog, I can't say that word.
Now, yeah, I don't know.
Now, okay. Anyways, moving on to real life sounds, they do a good job of being strange and harder to pinpoint. I should have like practiced
That's
that
okay.
before. I think that the tendency can ignite the imagination. It's perfect fodder for writing scary music. So I feel like the score does a really good job at like filling you with dread, which I mean, maybe for a non-horror fan, that wouldn't be a good thing, but for us, we love that. We love being filled with dread. Sometimes it like really creeps up on you, and at other times it's like in itself a jump scare, which I think is really fun. And I don't know, it just gets me excited when I watch it. And even though like I've seen it many times now, I'm always excited to see what happens next. And the music like really helps with that, which I can't say that for all horror movies that I've seen. And Vreeland says that like when it ignites the imagination, it really does that. And I don't think that this movie could be what it is without the music behind it.
Yeah, I
I really
totally agree.
don't.
Yeah, it definitely like adds to the tension without and adds to this like kind of timeless quality of the film. Right. And like yeah, just building on that timeless quality, like there's no contemporary songs in the film. There's no contemporary movies. Like the only sort of like piece of kind of modern technology is Yara's like Jay's friend has this like Kindle that's shaped like a shell that she's constantly reading from. But no
Yeah, I
one
always
ha
found that really. Go ahead, sorry.
Oh yeah, no worries. I was just gonna say like you don't really see like no one has a cell phone. Even like the cars are kind of like older and everything kind of has like the secondhand quality to it.
Yeah, there's like a lot of, I know like mid-century is like, you know, very in style and everything for like furniture, but there's like a lot of mid-century like old lamps and like weird, like, yeah, the cars, even their outfits, like her necklace, like it's like a shell necklace. Like, I don't know. I just think that it's very, it just seems very retro, which could bring us to our next
Oh,
point on
yes.
class.
Yes.
I actually found a quote from Blind Field Journal, which is called "It Follows Contemporary Horror and the Feminization of Labor." So it says, "It sometimes takes on the form of, a, or it, sorry, it sometimes takes on the form of lost loved ones, but for Jay, more frequently, it takes on the shape of a nude woman." Women who look like they've seen better days. Jay is at various times pursued by aggressively nude older women. The most
Sorry, I just
monstrous
love,
of them.
sorry to interrupt. I just love the term aggressively nude. So sorry for interrupting.
Aggressively nude older women. The most monstrous of them moves leadenly towards Jay while peeing on herself, and we see she's wearing only one dirty athletic sock. These concretizations of it as a depleted, abused, degraded, and oversexed woman plays out the surface allegory of the film, fear of the transition of sexual knowledge in adulthood. However, this fear is intrinsically linked to poverty, and the appearance of these women who are coded as homeless or prostitutes parallels of spatially of the film, which reviewer Charlie Lynn claims is structured around 8 Mile Road, a boundary that bisects the city into rich and poor sectors, as a metaphor for general for another great divide that between childhood and adulthood. This division between suburb and city, however, is something that characters mention with a kind of nostalgia, a fantasy that belongs to childhood. In the world that it follows, this boundary has eroded and the suburbs are seen to be in continuity with the ruined porn of the city. Detroit's dissected streets echo the deserted and overgrown streets of the suburbs. Urban regreening and suburban degradation mark the symbiotic futurelessness of capitalist space. After Jay's gang realize that she is indeed being followed by a supernatural entity, they set out to find Hugh, who might have more information on how to fight it. This is the first time we see the city. The camera lingers on the empty streets, burnt out, abandoned, graffitied warehouses and homes, and overgrown shrubbery. They go to Hugh's house, which turned out to be a squat that he had been staying in order to pass along it while remaining anonymous. The squat is notable for its similarity to Jay's house. It looks like the future vision of Jay and her friend's world, a large, filthy, empty husk of middle-class life. So the film takes place in Detroit, where there have been many foreclosures of people's homes and neighborhoods that have become desolate. And in horror films, we often see the suburb as this like boring setting, as the home of a white nuclear family with nice clothes, tidy homes, and good manners. But in this case, the landscape of suburbia itself can be the source of horror, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of like retro items, like we mentioned earlier, throughout the movie. Which at the same time gives the movie a retro feel paired with the soundtrack, which is cool, but it also gives the feeling of a slow suburban decay. And we no longer see the suburbs as they were meant to be seen, which is safe, comfortable, and thriving. And I think it's also interesting going back to water here that Jay's pool is littered with twigs and leaves and bugs. So something that is looked at to be like a luxurious thing, like a pool in your backyard, is starting to decompose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, just to go back to your point about, or that quote about Hugh, it is kind of like, kind of gross how he kind of like goes to these sort of like lower income, this lower income neighborhood, this kind of rundown mm-hmm. neighborhood to sort of like hunt and pass on his infection, yeah. basically. Gross.
Yeah.
And then he just like it's goes really back gross. To his like suburban home.
Yeah.
After.
Yeah, that's really gross.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really enjoyed the set design. Like I mentioned earlier, the furniture in Jay's home looks secondhand. Her house is a little run down. Appliances are pretty outdated, and I think that adds to the timelessness, but it also kind of shows a different type of family, maybe like a precarious class structure. Also, like I grew up in a home with like secondhand furniture and kind of outdated appliances and TVs and stuff. So it's just like, I don't know. I appreciated it. And so I just thought it was like, because in a lot of slashers, or a lot of horror, like the families are like beyond rich. So this is nice to see kind of like a regular middle class kind of rundown home.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. But yeah, but while It Follows discusses class and economic borders, the cast is predominantly white. Even when Jay and her friends leave their suburb, the urban areas and lower income neighborhoods are shown as being completely empty, almost like they're ghost towns. I can see the filmmakers trying to make a comment on the economic segregation of Detroit, but they're not really confronting the whiteness of the film. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like, they're pointing it out, but still engaging with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that is interesting. Mm-hmm. I wonder if it's, I don't know.
Yeah, I'm not really sure. Again, kind of like an unfinished thought, but I just thought that was like interesting. But yeah, I found an essay that kind of discusses race and class in films that are set in Detroit. It's titled Stalked by Precarity, Detroit, It Follows, and the End of the Urban Nightmare from screen25.com. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit of a long quote, so buckle up, everybody. As the most economically segregated city in the United States, it is perhaps no surprise that Detroit has proved such a rich source of horror and fascination. Yet far from telegraphing the place of the 700,000 people that continue to inhabit the metropolitan core, 90% of who are Black and Hispanic, this cultural zeitgeist seems peculiarly intent on erasing them from view. In It Follows, Black and working class characters have been almost entirely removed from the landscape, and the few that remain are ghostly, muted figures in the blurred background or the side of the screen. By imagining both a spatial detachment between the inner city and its surrounding suburbs and a moral one, these films seem to transform socioeconomic decline into another anti-urbanist story about human ruins and who are responsible for creating a damaged environment. But I would argue that It Follows does something different. Instead of embracing the narratives that have supported the flight of capital and people from Detroit's inner city, It Follows forces viewers to confront the real causes of Detroit's decline: the failure of state and market forces, enforced segregation, and a culture of fear. At the same time, it refuses to imagine either Detroit's landscape or its population as aberrations that can be eliminated, so to symbolically safeguard the sanctity of middle-class suburbia. Here, the slasher subgenre is plucked from its sealed suburban setting and redeployed in a fluid, changing metropolis. What pursues the characters is not a singular threat, but a widespread existential crisis that forces individuals to confront their own precarity. Their white protagonists might be represented as those with the ongoing power and authority to tell Detroit's story, but the disenfranchised others are foregrounded as figures forced to operate under various processes of erasure. By acknowledging how borders are created and sustained, they begin the crucial process of transforming metropolitan Detroit into a permeable spatiality whose symbolic boundaries can no longer hold. Sent on the run from an amorphous threat that can take any human form, suburbanite Jay and her naive friends have access to a mobility that her fictional predecessors could only dream of. And yet, as they flee in their cars from suburb to city, and from dilapidated ruins to coastal cottages, they find no relief. Wherever they go, the monster slowly, determinedly pursues them. Here, the suburb is no longer a refuge from a post-industrial decay, and attempts at white flight only enhance misery. In recent years, Detroit suburbs have confronted with plunging property values, foreclosures, and the steady migration of business back to parts of the increasingly populous urban core. In the end, the problem cannot be evaded or repelled. Instead, Jay and her friends must face and eventually accept the problems once symbolically relegated to the inner city. Okay, that was kind of long, but I just thought it was like a real great kind of like encapsulation of this idea of the suburbs being kind of this like safe haven for kind of like middle-class white people. Yeah. And how that is like, how that plays, it's also suffering.
Yeah.
From these economic anxieties and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's like the fact that they're like moving, like they go to this lake house to kind of like escape from this entity. Like they still like they can't escape from it still. Mm-hmm. And it's always still going to be there. Like no matter what, like it's always going to be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh yeah, there's also another sort of shot, or this idea of like these like white suburban kids sort of like imposing or like bringing this infection to sort of like marginalized areas. Cause we have Hugh sort of like slumming in this abandoned house. And then there's also a shot of Paul possibly like driving past to, I'm assuming like sex workers.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of the only right. shot. Yeah, so yeah. It's almost like it's insinuating that he is going to pass on this infection, knowingly pass it on.
Was that like I guess there's like sort of like a montage kind of scene. Was it kind of in that scene where like where they're like, this is what we're doing to take care of the situation?
Mm. Yeah,
because I guess it's like, you know, assumed that they're just like having sex with like anyone they could possibly have sex with to like get it farther away from them.
Yeah.
Which that's not cool.
Yeah. Which also brings up this sort of idea of like informed consent and what responsibility people have to let their partners know about stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think it necessarily like has any answers, but I feel like it's covering a lot of
these
kind of topics.
Yeah, I feel like the director made it like intentionally pretty ambiguous to like maybe have these questions be raised, which is interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Rather than the kind of like typical slasher of like, if you have sex, you're bad and you get killed.
Yeah. Yeah. I do like that. They've like kind of twisted that in the sense where it's like, you have sex and you may die, but you also have to have sex in order to not die.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, it gets kind of, messy, which like happens with any sort of like human interaction, I feel.
Exactly. Yeah.
Cool. Great. So good. Movie. If you haven't seen It Follows, you got to watch it.
It's on like every movie streaming service, which I find interesting. Like, it's on a lot of them. So you probably can watch it like very easily.
Yeah.
It's everywhere. Great movie. It's very creepy. And I like how it also doesn't have, like, it doesn't really rely on like gore or like, I mean, there are some jump scares, but there's not like, you know, like I know I said before, like the soundtrack kind of has like the jump. It's like,
it's doing a lot of the heavy lifting sort of scare-wise.
So yeah, I really like that about it. If you don't like gory movies or like bloody movies, like there's a little tiny bit, but like it's really, it doesn't rely on that too much, which is cool.
Yeah. There is one disturbing scene where you see the entity kill a character basically by having sex with him, and it's like twisted weird, but
it's a very I know what scene you're talking about, and it's very upsetting to say the least.
Yeah, not gory though, but
no, it's not upsetting. Gory, but once you know like the context, you'll be like, oh, this is gross. I don't know another word to say it. I don't want to like spoil it too much, but
It's a gross scene.
You'll know when it comes up.
Talia, thank you so much for suggesting this movie and for being on the show. Where can people find your work?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I love talking about horror movies. You can just go onto my Instagram. It's saint__Talica, or I have my website up at taliasteel.com, and I have it's all up there, so you can check it out.
Great. I'm gonna plug an event that I have coming up at Cinematech, where I am the programming coordinator. So I am organizing a Canadian horror film marathon on Saturday, October 30th. So we'll have a bunch of films kind of starting in the afternoon and going until it's over. So I think until like, the Sunday, the 31st. So it is like Halloween themed, please dress up. And that information will be on WinnipegCinematech.com soon, and also on our Facebook page. So please come.
So fun.
All right. Thank you so much for listening. You can listen to Bikini Drive-In every Sunday at 4 p.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM. You could also listen to it anywhere you can find podcasts. You could also follow me on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook. It's all Bikini Drive-In. So, thanks. Bye.
Bye.
powered by volunteer community involvement. This is CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg.